The signing. The unsigned transaction is sent to the hardware wallet, which returns the signed transaction without revealing the private key. Hardware wallets are more secure than software-only wallets, but nothing is infallible. Cold storage. The phrase "keeping coins in cold storage" was popular from 2013 through 2017, before hardware wallets became widely available. Remember, you don't store bitcoins, you store private keys. Cold storage is keeping a note of those private keys on offline media, such as a piece of paper or a computer not connected to the internet, as private keys are just strings of characters. You can see one as image 4.29 in the supplementary PDF. There are many ways of storing them. You can memorize keys if you have a good memory. You can print them out on bits of paper. You can even engrave them on a ring that you wear, like Charlie Shrem did, according to Wired magazine. You could store them on an offline computer, which, for increased security, should not have a modem or network card. You could write them down and put them in a bank's locked deposit box. These are all methods of storing your private keys offline. If you do keep private keys on a device or print it out, you wouldn't want someone else to be able to see it and use it to steal your bitcoins. So one way of increasing security is to first encrypt the private key with a passphrase that you can remember, and then store or print out the encrypted result. Passphrases are a lot easier to remember than private keys. This means that even if someone gets hold of the device or printout, they'd need to decrypt it with your passphrase before the private key is revealed. You can split keys or use multi-sig addresses for further security. This means if one part is found by a thief, it is useless without another part, and also means if one part is lost, the other two will still work. Remember, you are trying to simultaneously guard against two things: loss of keys and theft of keys. Hot wallets. A hot wallet is a wallet that can sign and broadcast transactions without manual intervention. Exchanges, who control many bitcoins, need to manage lots of bitcoin payments, as we will see later. They often have a hot wallet that controls a small proportion of their total bitcoins. Customers of exchanges like to withdraw bitcoins from the exchanges by clicking a button, causing an automated process to run to make and sign a bitcoin transaction, moving bitcoins from the exchange's hot wallet to the user's personal wallet. This means that somewhere, a private key belonging to the exchange must be stored on a hot machine connected to the internet. There is a trade-off between security and convenience. Online machines are easier to hack than offline machines, but can automate the process of creating and broadcasting Bitcoin transactions. Due to this trade-off, exchanges keep only a small fraction of Bitcoins in hot wallets, enough to satisfy customer demand, similar to banks that keep a small amount of cash in tellers' tills at branches. Buying and selling Bitcoins. You can buy Bitcoins from anyone who has them. Likewise, you can sell bitcoins to anyone who wants them. Fortunately, there are various places where you are likely to find a group of people willing to trade at competitive prices. Exchanges. Just like stock exchanges, bitcoin or cryptocurrency exchanges are places, usually websites, that attract traders. However, you don't buy bitcoins from the exchange itself. Just like a stock exchange, where you buy shares from another user of the exchange rather than from the exchange itself, a cryptocurrency exchange is the website that allows people to buy and sell between themselves. The exchange itself is just the location that brings together buyers and sellers, and people go there because they know they are likely to get the best prices there. In financial services jargon, the exchange is an order matching machine. It matches buyers and sellers. It also acts as the central clearing counterparty. All matched trades appear to be against the exchange rather than between the customers directly, providing anonymity for customers Finally, the exchange is the cash and asset custodian. It controls customers' fiat money in its bank account and cryptocurrencies in its wallet. How do cryptocurrency exchanges work? Exchanges are based in different countries and support different fiat currencies and different cryptocurrencies. They all work roughly the same way, using the same four steps. 1. Create account. 2. Deposit. 3. Trade. And 4. Withdraw. Create account. To use an exchange, just like a bank, you need to open an account. Exchanges are coming under increasing regulatory scrutiny due to the fact that they process large amounts of money. The top cryptocurrency exchanges match billions of dollars of buys and sells per day. Most legitimate exchanges follow a similar account opening procedure to banks, where new customers submit details and evidence of their identity, for example, passport and utility bills. The documentation needed may become more onerous in proportion to the value of fiat or cryptocurrencies you plan to transact in a progressive risk-based approach. Exchanges are now big business and take these processes seriously. Once the exchange is satisfied, your account is created, then you can log in, and the next step is to deposit. Deposit. Before you can attempt to buy or sell anything on an exchange, you need to fund your account. This is like funding an account with a traditional broker before being allowed to buy traditional financial assets. Exchanges have bank accounts and cryptocurrency wallets. In order to fund your account, you click on Deposit, then follow the instructions. If you are funding your account by fiat currency, presumably in order to buy cryptocurrency, then the exchange will display a bank account for you to make a fiat currency transfer to. If you're funding your account with cryptocurrency, presumably to sell for fiat currency or trade for a different cryptocurrency, then the exchange will display a cryptocurrency address for you to make a cryptocurrency transfer to. Once the exchange has detected the transfer to their bank account or cryptocurrency address, the balance will be reflected in your account balance on the exchange's website, and you are ready to trade. Trade. You can now trade up to the amounts you have deposited. For example, if you have deposited $10,000 in US dollars, then you can buy up to $10,000 worth of cryptocurrency. If you have deposited 3 bitcoins, then you can sell up to 3 bitcoins for fiat or other cryptocurrency that is available at that exchange. Prices are expressed in pairs that look something like this: bitcoins / US dollars, or BTC USD, with a number such as 8,000. The way to read this is, 1 unit of bitcoin costs 8,000 US dollars. Not all currencies can be traded for each other. It is really up to the exchange as to which pairs they enable. For example, you may see BTC USD and BTC EUR as trading pairs, meaning you can trade bitcoins with US dollars and trade bitcoins with euros, but you may not trade US dollars with euros directly if you don't see EUR USD. In that case, to convert US dollars into euros, you'd need to sell US dollars for Bitcoin, then use the Bitcoin to buy euros. You will see a screen of other people's bids and offers. These are the prices at which they are willing to trade and how much they are willing to trade at that price. You can decide either to match their prices, which will result in a matched trade, or submit your own orders, which will rest in the order book until someone matches your price, if they ever do. This is a financial market. This means that the larger amounts you want to buy or sell, the worse the prices will be. This is unlike a supermarket where you get a discount for buying in bulk. This is confusing for some people, initially, but it is easily explained. When you buy something on an exchange, the exchange will naturally match you off with the person who is selling it at the cheapest price. When you've bought all that they have to offer, you have to find the next best price, which will be slightly higher. Selling uses the same logic. When you sell something, the exchange will match you with the person who is willing to pay the highest price for it. When you have sold as much to them as they want to buy, you will have to go to the next highest price, which will be slightly lower. If you take a look at image 4.30 in the supplementary PDF, you'll see a screenshot of Bitfinex, a typical exchange. On the left-hand side is information about your balances in each currency, not shown here as this is a demonstration account. The main part of the screen shows a price and volume chart, meaning Bitcoin's price and how many Bitcoins have been traded. And the bottom third shows your open trades, that is, your orders that haven't been matched yet, and the full order book, that is, everyone's orders to buy and sell Bitcoins and their amounts and price levels. A ticker is shown on the bottom right, which streams the prices and amounts of matched trades in real time. Withdraw. Finally, you want to withdraw your fiat currency or cryptocurrency. To do so, you have to instruct the exchange where you want it to go. If you are withdrawing fiat, you'll need to tell the exchange your bank account details for them to make the transfer to you. If you are withdrawing cryptocurrency, you need to tell the exchange your cryptocurrency address so that they can make the cryptocurrency transaction. Usually, cryptocurrency withdrawals are faster for the exchange to process than fiat withdrawals, because most exchanges have hot wallets, as described earlier, which automate the process of sending small amounts of cryptocurrency back to users. How do exchanges make money? Exchanges make money by charging fees, just like your stockbroker. Different exchanges charge different fees in different ways. Some charge withdrawal fees. For example, if you withdraw $10,000, then they might send you $9,950, and you would receive even less than this because of bank fees. Others charge by taking a small fraction of every trade you do, usually by reducing the amount of whatever you are receiving. For example, if you have $8,000 in your exchange account and use it to buy bitcoins at a price of $8,000 per bitcoin, then you will receive slightly less than one bitcoin, say 0.995 bitcoins. Trading fees are usually determined by how much trading you do. So if you trade more, the fee rate decreases according to a published fee schedule. Pricing on different exchanges. The price of any asset at a cryptocurrency exchange depends on the participants using the exchange. Different exchanges can have different prices for each cryptocurrency because of the different participants using the exchange and the different levels of supply and demand on those exchanges. Usually, the prices are within a few percent of each other. If they get too out of line, arbitrageurs step in and buy the bitcoins from the exchange where they are cheap and sell them where they are trading at a premium. The extent to which arbitrageurs can keep doing this profitably affects how aligned the prices will ever become. To complete the circle of a successful arbitrage, you need to move the fiat, and sometimes this will have costs and time delays. To buy bitcoins on the cheap exchange, you need to move fiat currency there, buy bitcoins, withdraw the bitcoins, and send them to the more expensive exchange, then sell them, withdraw the fiat, and repeat the cycle. Each step has a financial cost and may not be instant. Some countries have currency controls which hinder cross-border exchange arbitrage. This is why there can be price differentials between exchanges for some time. In late 2013 to 2014, the exchange, Mt. Gox, traded at a premium to its competitor, Bitstamp, because people found they couldn't withdraw fiat from Mt. Gox, so instead, they had to buy bitcoins and withdraw the bitcoins instead. This created artificial demand for bitcoins on Mt. Gox, and the arbitrage of buying cheap bitcoins on Bitstamp and selling them on Mt. Gox didn't work because you couldn't get your fiat out of Mt. Gox. Regulation. Cryptocurrency exchanges perform activities that may be regulated in their operational jurisdictions. The fact that the instruments involved are cryptocurrencies does not necessarily mean that the exchanges escape local trading and tax disclosure requirements. However, depending on how the legislation is written, and owing to regulatory uncertainty, and the classification of cryptocurrencies, exchanges currently operate in a legal gray area, especially crypto-only exchanges who allow trades between cryptocurrencies but not fiat. Over-the-counter, OTC, brokers. When you buy on an exchange, you are buying from another customer of the exchange in quantities and prices agreed between you and the other customer. The exchange is only involved with the deal insofar as it acts as an escrow agent and has custody of your money and the other person's bitcoins until they become your bitcoins and the other person's money. Every trade is shown to all other participants, and the order book moves in real time in response to the trading activity. One characteristic of exchange trading that a large trader may wish to avoid is that transparency. Sometimes you want to trade large amounts without other traders knowing or without moving the market. Enter the brokers. These are people or companies with whom you establish a relationship. Instead of showing a transparent order book of customer orders, as the exchanges do, the brokers will buy and sell directly with you, negotiating a price for the full amount that you want to transact in what are known as block trades. Trade details are not published to the public. They are private transactions in bulk, and there is nothing illegal about this. This also happens in the traditional financial markets. Legitimate brokers also apply Know Your Customer processes to establish your identity and may be bound by local disclosure requirements. When you trade with a broker, there are two modes. The broker could act as principal to the trade or as agent. When the broker acts as principal, the deal is just between you and the broker. They are the counterparty to your trade. You tell them what you want to do, buy or sell, and in what amount. And they will tell you their best price, and you can say yes or no. It's like a large wholesale trade, and the broker needs to have enough money or cryptocurrency to complete the deal. In accounting jargon, the trade is on the broker's balance sheet because the broker itself is trading with you. This is the case, for example, when you buy foreign currencies at an exchange desk at an airport. When the broker acts as agent, the deal is between you and someone else with whom the broker is in touch. The broker acts as an intermediary who serves to provide anonymity to both parties. In accounting jargon, this is off the broker's balance sheet. It's not their money. They are just matching buyers and sellers. Generally, the way this works is that you contact the broker and tell them what you want to do. Then the broker will try to find another customer who wants to do the opposite to you. The other side of the trade. The broker will communicate price and amount information to both sides until the deal is agreed. The broker takes a fee from one or both customers for providing the service. Due to the large amount of manual overhead and small margins, brokers usually have a minimum trade size below which they won't pick up the phone. This can be anything from $10,000 to $100,000 per trade and seems to be increasing as the market matures. Local bitcoins. What if you don't want to go to an exchange or use a broker or provide any sort of identification? There is a website, localbitcoins.com, that acts a bit like eBay for people wanting to buy and sell cryptocurrencies. People post prices at which they are willing to buy and sell bitcoins. You can browse the list to find someone nearby, and you then agree to send them money in return for bitcoins, either by meeting physically with fistfuls of banknotes or by making bank transfers to their bank account. It's a bit like a bulletin board or eBay, and there is a reputation system with ratings and feedback comments. It also has an escrow function for the temporary custody of cryptocurrency. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto? We now come to the question. Who is Satoshi Nakamoto, and why does it matter? Satoshi was the author of the Bitcoin white paper and was active on cypherpunk mailing lists where like-minded people discuss ways of reclaiming personal privacy in the electronic age. After publishing the original white paper, Satoshi continued to participate on Bitcoin forums until December 2013, and then vanished. Satoshi also owns or controls a significant number of Bitcoins, estimated in 2013 by cryptocurrency security consultant Sergio Lerner at 1 million Bitcoins. This represents just under 5% of the total 21 million Bitcoins that will ever be created, if the protocol rules don't change. At 2018 prices of around $10,000 per Bitcoin, this puts the nominal value of the Bitcoins controlled by Satoshi at $10 billion. If Satoshi ever moves any Bitcoins thought to be associated with him or her, the community will immediately find out. The transactions will be visible on the blockchain, and addresses thought to be associated with Satoshi are monitored. This would almost certainly affect the price of Bitcoin. Satoshi's real-world identity matters because if the real person or group of people were discovered, their views and voice could dominate the future of Bitcoin. However, this centralization is what they are trying to avoid. They would also have extremely high personal security risk. It is never a good idea for people to know, or even believe, that you have significant amounts of wealth, especially in cryptocurrency. We have seen a number of high-profile cryptocurrency owners publicly state that they have sold all their cryptocurrencies. In January 2018, Charlie Lee, founder of Litecoin, LTC, publicly stated that he sold or donated all his LTC. In the same month, Steve Wozniak, founder of Apple, also stated that he had sold all of his Bitcoin. Although they have their reasons, I suspect that the high personal risk of being known owners of high-valued cryptocurrencies also feeds into this. I have had conversations with lucky Bitcoin owners who do not disclose their cryptocurrency wealth for precisely this reason. There have been a number of high-profile attempts at exposing Satoshi's identity. These are known in the industry as doxings, the public revelation of an internet nickname's real-world identity. It is, however, highly unlikely that the real truth about Satoshi's identity is among these doxings. On the 14th of March, 2014, a cover article for Newsweek magazine, which you can see as image 4.31 in the supplementary PDF, claimed that Satoshi was a 64-year-old Japanese gentleman named Dorian Nakamoto, birth name Satoshi Nakamoto, living in California. The article printed the suburb where Dorian lived and included a photograph of his house. This led to repeated harassment of Dorian and his family over the course of the next few weeks. Of course, Dorian was not Satoshi. To think that the privacy-loving cypherpunk creator of a revolutionary, unstoppable, anonymous digital currency would use his own name as his pseudonym is so far-fetched as to be ludicrous. To identify his home address is unethical. Nevertheless, and despite the best efforts of the journalist concerned, anecdotal evidence suggests that after a period of great distress, Dorian is now enjoying, and I hope monetizing, his newfound fame as the real, fake Satoshi. In December 2015, an article in Wired magazine suggested that Dr. Craig Wright, an Australian computer scientist, could be the mastermind behind Bitcoin. In March 2016, in interviews with GQ magazine, the BBC, and The Economist newspaper, Craig claimed to be the leader of the Satoshi team. He even published his own blog post, now taken offline, with these claims. Craig suggested that he didn't want to self-dox and that there may have been external pressures on him to do so. In June 2016, the London Review of Books published a long-form article where the journalist, Andrew O'Hagan, was able to spend an extended amount of time with Craig Wright. This is well worth a read in full, and my favorite part is, weeks later, I was in the kitchen of the house Wright was renting in London, drinking tea with him, when I noticed a book on the worktop called Visions of Future in Tokugawa, Japan. I'd done some mugging up by then and was keen to nail the name thing. So, that's where you say you got the Nakamoto part, I asked. From the 18th century iconoclast who criticized all the beliefs of his time?
Yes.
What about Satoshi?
It means ash, he said.
The philosophy of Nakamoto is the neutral central path in trade. Our current system needs to be burned down and remade. That is what cryptocurrency does. It is the phoenix.
So Satoshi is the ash from which the phoenix...
Yes. And ash is also the name of a silly Pokemon character. The guy with Pikachu. Wright smiled. In Japan, the name of ash is Satoshi, he said.
So basically you named the father of Bitcoin after Pikachu's chum?
Yes, he said. That'll annoy the buggery out of a few people. This was something you often said, as if annoying people was an art. Alas, the cryptographic proofs and demonstrations that Dr. Wright performed on and off camera were not watertight, and the community is still undecided as to the veracity of his claims. A few other Satoshi suspects have been Cypherpunk and PGP developer Hal Finney, smart contract and BitGold inventor Nick Szabo, cryptographer and creator of B-Money, Wei Dai, eDonkey, Mt. Gox, and Stellar creator Jed McCaleb, and Dave Kleiman. CoinDesk has a more extensive list of those suspected to be Satoshi. My bet is that Satoshi Nakamoto is not an individual, but a pseudonym for a group of people who have similar political views and who wish to remain anonymous. Craig Wright may have been part of that team. The team may not even know each other's real-world identities. Some of the team may have died since Bitcoin's popularization. We may get another clue in 2020, when the roughly 1 million Bitcoins locked in the Tulip Trust will be accessible. The Tulip Trust is a trust fund supposedly created by David Kleiman, an associate of Satoshi. It contains early Bitcoins potentially owned by Satoshi. If you decide to do some sleuthing, there are a few things to remember that people seem to have forgotten. A digital signature proves possession and use of a private key, but private keys can be shared among multiple people, so you cannot guarantee the mapping of a private key to an individual. Private keys can also be lost, an email address can be shared, a white paper can be written collaboratively, so grammatical clues simply reveal the habits of the editor, not necessarily those of the author. It is very hard to tie the identity of an individual to the author of a paper. On the other hand, it may be better if Satoshi is not found. Ethereum. What is Ethereum? The vision of Ethereum is to create an unstoppable, censorship-resistant, self-sustaining, decentralized, world computer. To achieve this, Ethereum builds on the concepts we saw with Bitcoin. If you consider Bitcoin as trustless validation and distributed storage of transaction data, Ethereum is trustless validation and distributed storage and processing of data and logic. Ethereum has a public blockchain running on 15,000 computers, and the token on the blockchain is called Ether, currently the second most popular cryptocurrency. Like Bitcoin, Ethereum is also a bunch of protocols written out as code, which is run as Ethereum software, which creates Ethereum transactions, containing data about Ether coins, known by the acronym ETH, recorded on Ethereum's blockchain. In contrast with Bitcoin, Ethereum transactions can contain more than just payment data, and the nodes in Ethereum are capable of validating and processing much more than simple payments. On Ethereum, you can submit transactions that create smart contracts, which are small bits of general-purpose logic that are stored on Ethereum's blockchain on all of the Ethereum nodes. These smart contracts can be invoked by sending Ether to them. This is a bit like deploying a juke machine, then putting coins in to play music. When a smart contract is invoked, all the Ethereum nodes run the code and update their ledgers with the results.
These transactions and smart contracts are run by all participants using a sort of operating system called an Ethereum virtual machine. Ethereum's blockchain can be interrogated using websites like etherscan.io. As with Bitcoin, there are also forks of the main Ethereum, such as Ethereum Classic, which is also a public blockchain. Each fork has a separate coin. Ethereum's coin is denoted ETH, whereas Ethereum Classic's coin is denoted ETC. The forks have a shared history with Ethereum up to a certain point in time, after which the blockchains differ. We'll discuss forks later. Ethereum's code can also be run as a private network, starting a new blockchain with limited participants. How do you run Ethereum? To participate in the Ethereum network, you can download some software called an Ethereum client, or you can write some yourself if you have the patience. Just like BitTorrent or Bitcoin, the Ethereum client will connect over the internet to other people's computers running similar client software and start downloading the Ethereum blockchain from them to catch up with the latest state of the blockchain. It will also independently validate that each block conforms to the Ethereum protocol rules. What does Ethereum client software do? You can use it to 1. Connect to the Ethereum network. 2. Validate transactions and blocks. 3. Create new transactions and smart contracts. 4. Run smart contracts. And 5. Mine for new blocks. Your computer becomes a node on the network, running an Ethereum virtual machine, and behaves equivalently to all other nodes. Remember, in a peer-to-peer network, there is no master server, and each computer is equivalent in status to any other. How is Ethereum similar to Bitcoin? Ethereum has an inbuilt cryptocurrency. Ethereum's token is called Ether, shortened to ETH. This is a cryptocurrency that can be traded for other cryptocurrencies or other sovereign currencies, just like Bitcoin. Ether ownership is tracked on the Ethereum blockchain, just like Bitcoin ownership is tracked on Bitcoin's blockchain. Ethereum has a blockchain. Like Bitcoin, Ethereum has a blockchain which contains blocks of data, that is, pure Ether payments as well as smart contracts. The blocks are mined by some participants and distributed to other participants who validate them. You can explore this blockchain on etherscan.io. Like Bitcoin, Ethereum blocks form a chain by referring to the hash of the previous block. Ethereum is public and permissionless. Like Bitcoin, the main Ethereum network is a public permissionless network. Anyone can download or write some software to connect to the network and start creating transactions and smart contracts, validating them, and mining blocks without needing to log in or sign up with any other organization. When people talk about Ethereum, they usually mean the main, public, permissionless version of the network. However, like Bitcoin, you can take Ethereum software, modify it slightly, and create private networks that are not connected to the main public network. The private tokens and smart contracts won't be compatible with the public tokens, though, just like private Bitcoin networks. Ethereum has proof-of-work, POW, mining. Like Bitcoin, mining participants create valid blocks by spending electricity to find solutions to a mathematical challenge. Ethereum's proof-of-work maths challenge, called ETHASH, works slightly differently from Bitcoin's and allows more common hardware to be used. It is deliberately designed to reduce the efficiency edge of specialized chips called ASICs, which are common in Bitcoin mining. Commodity hardware is allowed to compete efficiently, and this allows for a greater decentralization of miners. In practice, though, specialization hardware has been created, and so most blocks in Ethereum are created by one of a small group of miners. If you refer to image 4.32 in the supplementary PDF, you can see a pie chart of those top miners. On Ethereum's roadmap, there is a plan to move from electricity-expensive proof-of-work mining to a more energy-efficient proof-of-stake mining protocol called Casper in a future release of the Ethereum software called Serenity. Proof-of-stake is a mining protocol in which your chance of creating a valid block is proportional to the number of coins, or ETH, in your mining wallet. Contrast this to proof-of-work, where your chance of creating a valid block is proportional to the amount of computational cycles your hardware can crunch through. How might this impact the community? For starters, this would dramatically reduce the energy footprint of the cryptocurrency. Miners will no longer need to consume electricity competitively in order to win blocks. On the other hand, some people think that proof-of-stake is less democratic because those who already have accumulated a lot of Ether will have a higher chance of winning more blocks. So, the argument goes, new money will flow towards the wealthy, increasing the Gini coefficient of Ethereum holders. The Gini coefficient is a metric used to describe wealth inequality in a population. It's a number from 0 to 1, where 0 means everyone has the same wealth, and the number tends towards 1 as inequality increases. There are flaws in this less democratic argument. With proof of work, the high capital costs and expertise required mean that only a very small minority of people can actually make money mining. So it's not actually that democratic. Whereas with proof of stake, every ETH has an identical chance of winning a block, so you can get started with much less capital. Think of it as an interest rate. If you have more money, you get more interest. But at least those with small amounts of money can still get interest. I also think that reducing the negative externalities of pollution caused by proof of work is a decent and honorable goal. How is Ethereum different from Bitcoin? This is where it gets more technical and in many ways more complex. The Ethereum virtual machine can run smart contracts. When you download and run the Ethereum software, it creates and starts a segregated virtual computer on your machine called an Ethereum Virtual Machine, or EVM. This EVM processes all the Ethereum transactions and blocks and keeps track of all the account balances and results of the smart contracts. Each node on the Ethereum network runs the same EVM and processes the same data, resulting in them all having the same view of the world. Ethereum can be described as a replicated state machine because all of the nodes running Ethereum are coming to consensus about the state of the Ethereum virtual machine. Compared with Bitcoin's primitive scripting language, the code that can be deployed in Ethereum and run as smart contracts is more advanced and approachable for developers. We'll describe smart contracts in more detail later, but for now you can think of smart contracts as pieces of code run by all the nodes in Ethereum's virtual machine. Gas. In Bitcoin, you can add a small amount of Bitcoins as a transaction fee that goes to the miner who successfully mines the block. This compensates the miner for checking the validity of the transaction and including it in the block they are mining. Likewise, in Ethereum, you can add a small amount of Ether as a mining fee, which goes to the miner who successfully mines the block. The complication with Ethereum is that there are more types of transactions. Different transaction types have different computational complexities. For example, a transaction performing a simple Ether payment is less complex than a transaction to upload or run a smart contract. Therefore, Ethereum has a concept of gas, which is a sort of price list, based on the computational complexity of the different types of operation you are instructing the miners to make in your transaction. Operations include searching for data, retrieving it, making calculations, storing data, and making changes to the ledger. Here is the price list from the ethdocs.org website, which you can see as image 4.33 in the supplementary PDF. But it can change over time if the majority of the network agrees. A basic transfer of Ether from one account to another uses 21,000 gas. Uploading and running smart contracts uses more gas depending on their complexity. When you submit an Ethereum transaction, you specify a gas price, how much Ether you are willing to pay per gas used, and a gas limit, the maximum amount of gas you will let the transaction use. You can think of it as this equation. The mining fee in Ether is equal to the gas price in Ether per gas times the gas consumed in gas. Gas price. The gas price is the amount of Ether you are prepared to pay per unit of gas for the transaction to be processed. As with Bitcoin transaction fees, this is a competitive market. And in general, the busier the network, the higher the gas price people are willing to pay. In times of great demand, gas prices spike. You can see an example of this as image 4.34 in the supplementary PDF. Gas limit. The gas limit you set provides a ceiling for how much gas you are prepared for a transaction to consume. This limit protects you from overspending on mining fees, and you know that the maximum mining fee will be gas limit times gas price. This stops you overpaying if you accidentally submitted a very complex transaction that you thought was simple. Analogy time. Driving your car 10 kilometers will use up a certain amount of fuel. If you run out of fuel, your car will stop before reaching the destination. The price of fuel is dependent on market conditions and can go up and down, but the price of fuel bears no relation to how far you may drive your car with it. Gas in Ethereum is similar. When you submit an Ethereum transaction, you specify how much gas you're prepared to spend on making the transaction work. This is the gas limit, and how much Ether you are prepared to pay the miner per unit of gas. This is the gas price. This results in a total amount of Ether you're prepared to pay for the transaction to be processed. The miner will execute the transaction and will charge you the amount of gas taken, multiplied by the gas price you specified. As with Bitcoin, the mining fee is up to you, and you need to bear in mind that you are competing with other transactions, which may have set a higher gas price. For example, a basic transaction of a transfer of Ether from one account to another uses 21,000 gas. So you can set the gas limit for this kind of transaction to 21,000 or higher, but it will only use 21,000 gas. If you set the gas limit below the amount of gas it takes to process the transaction will fail, and you will not be refunded your mining fee. This is like trying to make a journey with insufficient fuel in your tank. The fuel will be used, but you will not get to your destination. ETH units. Just like $1 can be split into 100 cents, one Bitcoin can be split into 100 million Satoshi. And Ethereum, too, has its own unit naming convention. The smallest unit is a wei, and there are 1 followed by 18 zeros of them per ether. There are also some other intermediate names: Finney, Szabo, Shannon, Lovelace, Babbage, Ada, all named after people who made significant contributions to fields related to cryptocurrencies or networks. Wei and Ether are the two most common denominations. Wei is usually used for gas price, a gas price of between 2 to 50 giga wei per gas is common, where 1 giga wei is 1 billion wei. You can see a further breakdown of units in Ethereum by looking at image 4.35 in the supplementary PDF. Ethereum's block time is shorter. In Ethereum, the time between blocks is around 14 seconds, compared with Bitcoin's 10 minutes. This means that, on average, if you made a Bitcoin transaction and an Ethereum transaction, the Ethereum transaction would be recorded into Ethereum's blockchain faster than the Bitcoin transaction into Bitcoin's blockchain. You could say Bitcoin writes its database roughly every 10 minutes, whereas Ethereum writes to its database roughly every 14 seconds. The history of Ethereum's block times has been quite interesting, as you can see, on bitinfocharts.com, or as image 4.36 in the supplementary PDF. Compare this with Bitcoin's relatively stable block time, as image 4.37 in the supplementary PDF. Note the timescale, as Bitcoin is much older than Ethereum. Ethereum has smaller blocks. Currently, Bitcoin's blocks are a little under 1 megabyte in size, whereas most Ethereum blocks are about 15 to 20 kilobytes in size. However, we should not compare blocks by the amount of data in them. While Bitcoin's maximum block size is specified in bytes, Ethereum's block size is based on complexity of contracts being run. It is known as a gas limit per block, and the maximum is allowed to vary slightly from block to block. So whereas Bitcoin's block size limit is based on amount of data, Ethereum's block size limit is based on computational complexity. You can see an example of this as image 4.38 in the supplementary PDF. Currently, the maximum block size in Ethereum is around 8 million gas. Basic transactions or payments of Ether from one account to another, that is, uploading or invoking a smart contract, have a complexity of 21,000 gas. So you can fit around 380 of those basic transactions into a block, that's 8 million divided by 21,000. In Bitcoin, you currently get around 1,500 to 2,000 basic transactions in a 1 megabyte block. Uncles, blocks that don't quite make it. Because Ethereum's rate of block generation is much higher than Bitcoin's, 250 blocks per hour on Ethereum versus 6 blocks per hour on Bitcoin, the rate of block clashes increases. Multiple valid blocks can get created at almost the same time, but only one of them can make it into the main chain. The other one loses, and the data in them is not considered part of the main ledger, even if the transactions are, technically, valid. In Bitcoin, these non-main chain blocks are called orphans or orphaned blocks, and they do not form part of the main chain in any way and are never referenced again by any subsequent blocks. In Ethereum, they are called uncles. Uncles can be referenced by a few of the subsequent blocks, and although the data in them is not used, the slightly smaller reward for mining them is still valid. This achieves two important things. One, it incentivizes miners to mine even though there is a high chance of creating a non-main chain block. The high speed of block creation results in more orphans or uncles. And two, it increases the security of the blockchain by acknowledging the energy spent creating the uncle blocks. Transactions that end up in orphan blocks simply end up being remined on the main chain. They don't cost the user any more gas because the transaction in the orphaned block is treated as if it was never processed. Accounts. Bitcoin uses the word address to describe accounts. Ethereum uses the word account, but technically they are also addresses. The words seem to be more interchangeable with Ethereum. Maybe you can say, what's the address of your Ethereum account? It doesn't seem to matter. You can see an image of this as 4.39 in the supplementary PDF. There are two types of Ethereum accounts. One, accounts that only store Ether. And two, accounts that contain smart contracts. Accounts that only store Ether are similar to Bitcoin addresses and are sometimes known as externally owned accounts. You make payments from these accounts by signing transactions with the appropriate private key. Accounts that contain smart contracts are activated by a transaction sending Ether into it. Once the smart contract has been uploaded, it sits there at an address waiting to be used. ETH token issuance. The issuance of Ether tokens is a bit more complicated than Bitcoin. The number of Ether in existence are pre-mine plus block rewards plus uncle rewards. You can see an example of this as image 4.40 in the supplementary PDF. Pre-mine. Around 72 million Ether were created for the crowd sale in July and August 2014. This is sometimes called a pre-mine, as they were just written in rather than mined through proof-of-work hashing. These were distributed to initial supporters of the project and to the project team itself. It was decided that after the initial crowd sale, future Ether generation would be capped at 25% of the pre-mine total, that is, no more than 18 million Ether could be mined per year. Block rewards. Originally, each block mined created 5 fresh Ether as the block reward. Due to concerns about oversupply, this was reduced to 3 Ether in a set of changes to the protocol called the Byzantium Update in October 2017 on block 4,370,000. To see an example of this, see image 4.41 in the supplementary PDF. Uncle rewards. Some blocks are mined but don't form part of the main blockchain. In Bitcoin, these are called orphans and are entirely discarded, and the miner of the orphaned block receives no rewards. In Ethereum, these discarded blocks are called uncles and can be referenced by later blocks. If a later block references an uncle, the miner of the uncle gets some Ether. This is called the uncle reward. The miner of the later block referencing the uncle also gets an additional small reward called an uncle referencing reward. The uncle reward used to be 4.375 Ether. That's 7/8 of the full 5 Ether reward. It was reduced in the Byzantium upgrade to between 0.625 to 2.625 Ether. You can see an example of the Ethereum uncle count and rewards chart as image 4.42 in the supplementary PDF. The biggest difference between Ether and Bitcoin token generation is that Bitcoin generation halves approximately every 4 years and has a planned finite cap, whereas Ether generation continues to be generated at a constant number every year indefinitely. Like any other parameter or rule, however, this rule is subject to ongoing debate and can be changed if the majority of the Ethereum network agrees. You can see a graph of the Bitcoin versus Ether issuance models as image 4.43 in the supplementary PDF. The future of ETH generation.
The Ethereum community hasn't yet come to agreement about what happens to the rate of issue when Ethereum moves from proof of work to proof of stake. Some argue that perhaps the rate at which Ethereum is created should decrease, as the value will not have to subsidize competitive electricity usage. Mining rewards. In Bitcoin, the miner of a block receives the block reward, new Bitcoins, plus transaction fees for transactions mined, existing Bitcoins. In Ethereum, the miner of a block receives the block and uncle referencing rewards, the new Ethereum, plus mining fees, gas amount times gas price, from transactions and contracts that were run during the block. Other parts to Ethereum, Swarm and Whisper. Computers need to be able to calculate, store data, and communicate for Ethereum to realize its vision as an unstoppable, censorship-resistant, self-sustaining, decentralized world computer. It needs to be able to do those 3 things in an efficient and robust way. The Ethereum virtual machine is just one component of the whole, the element which does the decentralized calculations. Swarm is another component. This is for peer-to-peer file sharing, similar to BitTorrent, but incentivized with micropayments of Ether. Files are split into chunks, distributed and stored with participating volunteers. These nodes that store and serve the chunks are compensated with Ether from those storing and retrieving the data. Whisper is an encrypted messaging protocol that allows nodes to send messages directly to each other in a secure way, and that also hides the sender and receiver from third-party snoopers. Governance.
Although Bitcoin and Ethereum are both open-source projects and open, permissionless networks, one of the biggest differences between them is that Bitcoin doesn't have an active, identified leader, whereas Ethereum does. Vitalik Buterin, the creator of Ethereum, is hugely influential, and his opinions count. Although he can't stop his creation or censor transactions or participants, his vision and commentary have a big impact on the technology. For instance, he championed a hard fork to recover funds stolen in the DAO hack. This is explained later. He also proposes changes to the protocol rules and the network economics. Bitcoin, on the other hand, has a few influential developers, but none with the clout that Vitalik has with Ethereum. Nick Tamano argues in a blog post that the governance of blockchains may prove to be as important as the computer science and economics of blockchains. Whether a single influencer is good or bad for decentralized cryptocurrency networks is still to be determined. Smart contracts. Smart contracts mean different things depending on the blockchain platform. Ethereum smart contracts are short computer programs that are stored on Ethereum's blockchain, replicated across all the nodes, and are available for anyone to inspect. There are two steps that are performed separately. One, uploading the smart contract to Ethereum's blockchain, and two, making the smart contract run. You upload a smart contract by sending the code to miners in a special transaction. If the transaction is successfully processed, the smart contract will then exist at a specific address on Ethereum's blockchain. You may then make it run by creating a transaction that says, "Please run the smart contract found at address X." To see an example of a basic smart contract, look for image 4.44 in the supplementary PDF. It creates a token called GavCoin that initially issues 1 million GavCoins to the creator of the smart contract, and then allows them to send GavCoins to other users. Once a contract has been uploaded, it behaves a bit like a jukebox. When you want to run it, you create a transaction pointing to the contract and supply whatever information the contract expects. You pay gas to the miner to run it. As part of the mining process, each miner will execute the transaction, which involves running the smart contract. The miner who successfully wins the proof-of-work challenge will publish the winning block to the rest of the network. The other nodes will validate the block, add the block to their own blockchains, and process the transactions, including running the smart contracts. Here is how Ethereum's blockchain gets updated, and how the state of the EVMs on each node's machine is synchronized. Ethereum smart contracts are described Turing complete. This means that they are fully functional and can perform any computation that can be done in any other programming language. Smart contract languages: Solidity, Serpent, and LLL, Lisp-like language. The most common language that Ethereum smart contracts are written in is Solidity. Serpent and LLL can also be used. Smart contracts written in these languages will all compile and run on Ethereum virtual machines. Solidity is similar to the language JavaScript. This is currently the most popular and functional smart contract scripting language. Serpent is similar to the language Python and was popular in the early history of Ethereum. And LLL is similar to Lisp and was used mainly in the very early days only. It's probably the hardest to write in. Ethereum software: GETH, ETH, and PyThap. The three official Ethereum clients, full node software, are all open source. You can see the code behind them and tweak them to make your own versions. They are: 1. GETH, written in a language called Go. 2. ETH, written in C++. And 3. PyThap, written in Python. These are all command line based programs. Think green text on black backgrounds, and so additional software can be used for a nicer graphical interface. Currently, the most popular graphical interface is Mist, which you can find online at github.com/Ethereum/Mist, which runs on top of GETH or ETH. So GETH/ETH does the background stuff, and Mist is the pretty screen on top. Currently, the most popular Ethereum clients are GETH and Parity. Parity is Ethereum software built by a company called Parity Technologies. It is also open source and is developed in the Rust programming language. Ethereum's history. Ethereum is a highly successful public blockchain by adoption, mindshare, and the number of developers working on Ethereum smart contracts and decentralized apps. Here is a short history of Ethereum and some difficult periods in its history that it has managed to overcome. 2013. Vitalik Buterin described Ethereum as a concept in a white paper in late 2013. This concept was developed by Dr. Gavin Wood, who published a technical yellow paper in April 2014. Since then, the development of Ethereum software has been managed by a community of developers. A crowd sale took place in July and August 2014 to fund development, and Ethereum's live blockchain was launched on the 30th of July, 2015. You can see the very first block by going to etherscan.io/block/0. Ethereum crowd sale. The development team was funded by an online sale of Ether tokens during July to August 2014, where people could buy Ether tokens by paying in Bitcoin. Early investors received 2,000 Ether per Bitcoin, and this was gradually reduced to 1,337 Ether per Bitcoin over the course of about a month to encourage investors to invest early. Crowd sale participants sent Bitcoins to a Bitcoin address and received an Ethereum wallet containing the number of Ether bought. Technical details are on Ethereum's blog. A little over 60 million Ether was sold this way for more than 31,500 Bitcoin, worth about $18 million US at the time. An additional 20%, or 12 million Ether, were created to fund development and the Ethereum Foundation. Software release codenames. Frontier, Homestead, Metropolis, and Serenity are friendly names for versions of the core Ethereum software.